Welcome to another legislative podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler, representative for the 100th Legislative District in Lancaster County. I'm your host, Chuck Nichols. Brian, welcome to another podcast. The first thing we'd like to talk about this time is the jobs initiative, career and technical development, the education aspect that we've been doing here with all the legislation we've been moving here in the state. We've been trying to get things better for employees and employers across the state. Talk to us about the legislation that has been passed, how it's been moving, and what our overall goals are and how they've been getting achieved.
The House just recently passed a rather large package of bills that were bipartisan in nature, both Republican and Democrat bills, that focused really on two components. One on the education components, and then one on the training components of developing a workforce. And really what the goal there is to close the skills gap between the number of jobs that are currently open. Literally, there are thousands of them. We have more jobs than we do available workers at this point. But close the skills gap between those folks and where the job market currently is. We started this last year in the education code by requiring the top 10 highest demand jobs in the Commonwealth to be posted. This is data that we've collected forever. I think most folks would agree that it makes sense to make this information available, especially if we're already collecting it. And more importantly, what you need to have in order to do those jobs. In many ways, it mirrors my own path that I took into the career field that I chose, which was being an X-ray technologist right after high school. That was a two-year training program. It was not anything more than a certificate to sit for the national boards. It did not even meet the credit requirements for being an associate's level degree. That has since changed for the program that I attended, but at that time, it was essentially a trade school. And while I was able to do that, passed my boards, had a job, I eventually went back to school, focused once again in that same field, healthcare and healthcare administration, and finished my bachelor's degree and ultimately a law degree. And really what the focus has always been is to have a pathway from one job to the next. It may not seem apparent right out of the gates. For example, if you would have said I'd eventually become a lawyer, most folks would probably ask why I took the path I did. But if you look at each individual stop along the way, I would offer that it makes sense. They're all related to healthcare. They're all related to career development. And it culminated in a law degree that was focused on all of the business, ethical, and hands-on practice areas that I came from.
And I think that's something that we need to remind folks and focus on is that when you started and what we're talking about with a lot of these opportunities, when people start, especially folks like you, you start off with maybe one goal. Say, hey, I need to get a job. I need to make a little bit of money. And it doesn't mean that your career has to be decided right then and there. All these steps that you took were one after the other because you found interest in the field that you were in or found an area in that you felt that you could change. And each step you took you one step further down the career path. Doesn't mean that a lot of folks might not stop at step two or step three. Some people want to get to step 10 and become president of the United States. But we're not trying to limit folks or say that we have to have everything figured out in a two-year time span.
Well, I think that's probably the biggest disservice that we do for young students in today's world is this misbelief that you have to decide your career path from the exact second that you leave high school to where you're going to be. I often joke, even with my own children, that I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up because I've been able to have a wonderful variety of careers from being an X-ray tech to being a manager in a hospital to being an attorney and a legislator and melding all of my life experiences together for this great opportunity. And so I think it's important that we build into any educational system the idea of options as you go forward and the ability to essentially stack on skill sets and add on. Because unlike my father, who worked at that time, it was Sperry New Holland, eventually became Ford New Holland when he was there, and I think it's Case International New Holland now. He was the stereotypical from the day he graduated to the day he went out on disability and eventually passed away with an illness. He worked at the same place. He had different jobs there, but he did the same thing. And the idea of going to one employer for the rest of your life does not exist in today's workplace as much as it once did. Look at myself. I've had a multitude of employers. I've had a multitude of career experiences, but each one has successively built on the other. And that kind of opportunity is really what we should give every student, because we want to give them the opportunity to succeed. And through the educational system, we want to give them the tools to continue learning and continually adapt, because I think that's really what it's about. That's what the bills that we passed out of the House do. I know that there's been a lot of talk about, well, should we change minimum wage? Should we do other things? The truth is, I would much rather focus on jobs that are paying far above minimum wage. And that's what this package does, because we already know that we need more workers. So if we know that we have vacancies in high-paying jobs, we should never be satisfied to put people in minimum wage jobs when we know that we can escalate them quickly up the economic ladder in terms of workforce employment opportunities. Let's invest in and give them the opportunities to get those jobs that pay much more. And I think that is really a philosophical difference, if you will. I'm convinced that you're going to get more of whatever you focus your policies on. In this case, if you focus on making the minimum wage increase or change that range, you're going to get more minimum wage jobs. And I'd rather focus on those jobs which we know are already vacant, that already need workers, and that pay very, very well. This is about providing family-sustaining jobs.
And leaving minimum wage jobs for those workers who are just entering the workforce so that they can get a little bit of beginning experience and start this path and start climbing this ladder. The next thing we'd like to talk about, Representative, is some feedback that we got on the first couple programs we did. You've been hearing that we in Pennsylvania are a little bit less contentious than they are in Washington. We seem to be getting some things done in our state that are being done without having so much fighting, without having disagreement, and actually achieving things that across the aisle are universally agreed upon. Talk to us about the approach that you've had since you've become a legislator at reaching across the aisle to get things done, and maybe some insight into achieving legislative goals by building this consensus.
Well, one thing's for sure, and I think our listeners have it right, we're not Washington, D.C., and for that I'm very grateful. This is really an approach. It's not new for me in my role as leader. Quite frankly, it's something that I have practiced since my early days, at that time out of necessity because we were in the minority, but since then because I ultimately think it's the way that people expect the legislative process to work. I do try to work with Democrats on issues. I recognize that some issues there are simply philosophical differences. That's fine. We can respect that. But that doesn't mean that we can't work together on the other issues that we do agree on. And oftentimes, we saw it with the jobs package that I just referenced in the prior segment. There was broad bipartisan support, not just for the votes for the bills, but the actual sponsors of the people that were pushing the bills. It was nearly a 50-50 split coming out of the Education Committee, half Republican, half Democrat bills. All of them passed with only a handful of no votes across all of the bills that passed. And I was very proud of that effort and the legislators that I work with, because we can focus and agree on some pretty big and important things. Personally, it's something that I've done. My first bill that I was able to have signed into law came from an interaction with a hunter. It dealt with constitutional search and seizure law, which certainly doesn't sound that exciting. I know that. But the truth of the matter is our statutes were unconstitutional and needed updated. So myself and Representative Bill Kortz worked on it from Allegheny County, and he's a Democrat. Bill's approach, and it's one that I admire, was I went to him and said, hey, here's an idea for a bill. I'll give it to you. Let's get it done. I'll help you on my side of the aisle. He looked right at me, and I'll never forget. He says, I don't care whose name on it. A good idea should get a vote, and let's move. And Bill helped me move my bill through the process. He was a member of the majority party at that time, and it was ultimately signed into law by Governor Rendell. And I was humbled by that effort, and I've tried to reciprocate that since then. I've worked with Bill on some other issues. I've worked with a host of other Democrats on issues that range from hospital licensing that took 30 years to get done, but I was fortunate enough to pair up with Pam DeLisio, from Philadelphia, Montgomery County. She's a Democrat, a former nursing home administrator, so she understood the health system. And we were able to find agreement on that bill and have that pass the House unanimously and signed into law by Governor Corbett. And we've done issues that most people on the outside would assume would be contentious, such as welfare reform. We reformed the LIHEAP program. That's the Low-Income Heating and Energy Assistance Program. I worked with a representative from Philadelphia on that one. And that one, it was interesting and kind of funny because he got grief for working with me on a welfare reform bill. They said, why would you work with that conservative from Lancaster County? And what we were able to each share was, obviously, as Democrats, they were worried about what would happen to the program. And he said, no. He said, hear me out. He goes, I've talked to Brian. Here is the issue. That program has 2 to 3 times the number of applicants, and they run out of money before they get to the end of the line. And the problem is the people that are actually getting the help are cheating to get it. So they're stealing money from all of our constituents. Our side, the Republican side, loved it because we were reforming a program that we knew had fraud in it. And we were focusing on specifically those individuals that truly needed the money. That was a win-win for both sides. That bill passed unanimously and was also signed by Governor Corbett. So I think that's the approach that best serves the citizens of the Commonwealth. And I think it lends itself to making the legislative process itself a lot easier.
And moving forward, it seems like we're going to be achieving a lot more. It seems like also during this push recently, as things have gotten going this session, we've been pushing towards some new legislative initiatives and having some defined goals as we move forward. And the next goal that we have been looking at is a crime and victims package of legislation. And this can be really kind of confusing and also can kind of get into the weeds really quick because we're talking about legislation that changes our system of jurisprudence. We're talking about victim advocacy. On one hand, you have our current criminal justice system that has the rights of the accused, the innocent until proven guilty. You can face your accuser in court. And now we also have to consider the rights of the victim. You know, we don't want to be dragging child victims in front of the court. We don't want to be causing undue hardship for victims. Talk to us about weighing one versus the other when we're talking about these changes in the law and creating new rights for victims.
I think when you look at our criminal justice system, that everybody recognizes that there are two parties. You have the accused, which certainly deserves to have the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. But then you also have the victim who didn't ask to be in that situation. And we're striking that balance between those two parties with many of these bills. Just like the education system and the workforce development bills that we talked about previously, these bills are bipartisan in nature. I expect that in addition to having sponsors from both parties on these bills, I also expect there to be strong bipartisan support for many of these. And I think that when it comes down to the victims, we have to ask ourselves, they didn't ask to be put in this situation. What can we do to minimize the disruptions to their lives as they testify? And then two, how do you help them reintegrate back into society? Because we oftentimes hear stories about individuals who have been victims of violent crime or assaults, and it forever impacts their lives. And when you look at something like Marcy's Law, which is the proposal for a victim's bill of rights that would be added to our Constitution, that passed last session. So if it passes this session again, and I expect it will because it passed overwhelmingly last time, that will go out to be on the voter referendum. It'll be on our next ballot after so many days after advertising and the necessary components related to the constitutional process. So that'll be something that you and I and every voter gets a chance to have a say in, is should victims have rights in this process, rights to be notified when their convicted assailant is going to be getting out of prison, to testify what impacts they have had on their lives. And I think that that is appropriate. I think that when you look at some of the other victims, I think that we need to protect those individuals with disabilities, the young, the tender years is what it's called, the tender years exception. And I think that we need to strengthen those laws. And we should also shield rape victims who are brave enough to come forward and protect them from irrelevant cross-examinations. And I know that some of these may be controversial, but that's why we run the House floor the way that we do. Everyone will have their chance to have their input. And specific to the constitutional amendment that I opened to talk about, we as voters will get an input on that. And I can't overstate the importance of that. We do not routinely amend our Constitution. So to enshrine that Bill of Rights in that manner, I think, is significant. And, you know, I congratulate Representative Cheryl DeLosier, who's led the fight on that. She's a wonderful colleague and prior victims advocate herself. So she personally understands the hardships and the nature of this. And when you look at all of the other individuals who are bringing the bills forward, many of them have personal stories as well. And I think that it would be good for us as a legislature to listen to those and understand how these processes, which we tend to get hung up sometimes on the legal nature of it, the, you know, the plaintiff and the defendant and the accused and, you know, all things that we hear about on or see in the news and television. But we have to remember the victims. We plan on highlighting that over the next week and a half to 2 weeks with our floor action. And I think that it's important that we hear the stories, because that was something that I had shared my own story on Swearing In Day. I'd invited everybody else to share theirs and how that impacts their life, their worldview, how they view legislation, how they vote. And I think we could all learn something from one another. And I look forward to working with everybody to get these bills accomplished.
And it's something we have to remember, that in every one of these situations, we're talking in the abstract when we're talking about these bill changes and the changes in the law, but each one of these has an effect on the people that are involved, both the victim and the accused, in all these situations. The final thing I'd like to ask, as far as the legislation that has been moving and moved so far, how are we doing in negotiations with the Senate? How are we doing in negotiations with the budget? Moving forward, are things moving smoothly?
Well, I've been pleasantly surprised at the pace at which we've already jumped into some, honestly, very weighty and heavy issues. But that was really the direction of the House. That's where the House wanted to go. Obviously, the budget will be a backdrop for us as we move forward. And that will culminate end of May, beginning of June, hopefully. I expect that as revenues are currently ahead, that discussion will probably be easier than in years past. But we still have to significantly bend our cost curves going forward. And that's a fancy term that we use here in Harrisburg, but here's the reality. Our bills are increasing faster than our tax base. In other words, we're spending more than we're bringing in, and we have to get that under control. So that will probably dominate our budget discussions. Those will, while very important, will continue kind of behind the scenes at this point, because all of these other bills are taking front and center at this time, and arguably rightfully so, because these are also very important policy issues that will have a direct impact on our budget. Our corrections costs continue to be rapidly increasing. So it's important that we balance victims' rights and the rights of the accused. And it's important that we reintegrate people back into society once they've paid their debt to society.
And make sure they're working once they get back in.
Right. And we can't be surprised when we close all the doors of opportunity for people that have gotten out of prison, and then we tell them that they can't work in a whole host of different areas because of their prior convictions. We can't be surprised that they go back to their life of crime. So in that world, we have to be smart about how we strike that balance and make sure, and this really goes back to the first package of bills, make sure that everyone has an opportunity to succeed here in the Commonwealth while balancing a lot of different rights, thoughts, and viewpoints.
Representative Culler, thank you for this informative report to your constituents and everyone across the Commonwealth, and we'll talk more in our next podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Culler.